Lorna's haunting photographs and poignant stories enable her audience to share the tragedy, the struggle, the triumph of the Iraqi people. And they raise larger questions about the war, a war that was never necessary, which could have been stopped if only the warmongering governments heard the voice of the people. And that's it, everyone, for this week on Aperture. Until another episode right here on Aperture, goodbye. Thank you.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
When Psaki scoffed at the idea of sending Americans free COVID-19 rapid tests, it was a reminder that a for-profit healthcare system still limits the U.S. pandemic response. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Robert McKee, writer. This article is published under the heading Jen Psaki Accidentally Tells the Truth About How Expensive COVID Rapid Tests Are in the U.S. Stay tuned for more. Public health experts were appalled to hear an idea that many of them consider vital, making at-home rapid antigen tests for COVID-19 free for all Americans, dismissed as ridiculous by President Joe Biden's press secretary, Jen Psaki. In an oddly combative exchange with Mara Leeson of NPR, who asked why the United States chose not to emulate countries like the United Kingdom, which sends packs of 7 free rapid tests to anyone who asks for them, the president's spokesperson first suggested wrongly that the tests used in other countries might not work. Psaki then boasted that the U.S. had gotten some retailers to lower costs and would soon require private insurance companies to start reimbursing clients who buy rapid tests. Leeson said, "That's kind of complicated, though. Why not just make them free and give them out? Make them available everywhere." Psaki shot back, her voice dripping with sarcasm. "Should we just send one to every American?" Eliasson replied, "Maybe." "Then what happens if every American has one test? How much does that cost?" Psaki asked, suggesting that sending Americans tests to regularly screen themselves for the virus would be prohibitively expensive. Experts who have pushed for the Biden administration to flood the country with free rapid tests as a way of finding asymptomatic cases to slow the spread of the virus were particularly outraged that the president's spokesperson suggested that the initiative would be too costly. By dismissing the idea of sending every American a rapid test due to cost, she seems to imply that the insurance reimbursement plan won't come close to doing that. Jennifer Nuzzo, lead epidemiologist for the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center, commented on Twitter. Nuzzo had complained to The Hill earlier this week that the administration was placing barriers in front of people by not simply buying tests for all Americans. She said the most preferable option would be to make these government things free or close to free and make them widely available so people can just pick them up. Rapid tests are hard to get, expensive, and could be a key intervention in fighting COVID-19. Greg Gonzalez, an associate professor of epidemiology at Yale Medical School, wrote in a tweet addressed to Psaki and Jen Zients, the White House COVID-19 response coordinator. Other countries have figured out better ways to get these tools into the hands of their citizens. Do better. Give out rapid tests to every household? Yes, of course, we should. Oni Blackstock, a doctor who once led New York City's response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic, chimed in a tweet, adding that this appears to be some quixotic idea to the administration is incredibly concerning and a reminder of why we have not been able to get control of this pandemic here in the U.S. Michael Mina, a physician who teaches at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, estimated more than a year ago that the spread of COVID-19 could be dramatically curtailed if just half of the U.S. population tested themselves every 4 days with at-home rapid kits that could cost the U.S. government as little as $5 billion. Mina, who argues that the U.S. government should mail rapid tests to every American household, suggested that Psaki's comments reveal that the administration is unwilling to take emergency measures to fight the coronavirus pandemic that might challenge the nation's fundamentally for-profit healthcare system. What Psaki's comments accidentally drew attention to is that even during a pandemic, Americans are still paying more for healthcare than their counterparts in countries with great medicines or single-payer systems. Experts like Mina Anutso have urged the U.S. government to use its leverage to press test makers to sell the kits for between $1 and $5 each. But because the Biden administration has tried to work within the constraints of America's for-profit-driven system, commercially available rapid tests are considerably more expensive for consumers and often hard to find in stores. Abbott Labs, Binox, and OW Kit, for instance, can be purchased by the government for $5 each, but cost consumers $11.99 a test at CVS or Walgreens.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Germany has a new chancellor. Social Democrat Olaf Scholz has been sworn in as Germany's new chancellor, ending 16 years of conservative rule under Angela Merkel. Scholz, who is now 63, had served as vice chancellor and finance minister in Merkel's outgoing government. He got 395 votes from lawmakers in the lower house of parliament. Scholz will oversee a liberal-left coalition government between the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, the Greens, and the Liberal Free Democratic Party, or the FDP. This is the first power-sharing agreement of such a kind in Germany, and the first governing alliance with three parties since 1957. Merkel's final days as chancellor was her 5,860th day in office, falling short of the record set by her late former mentor, Helmut Kohl, by a mere 10 days.
Well, the positive is that she actually kept the German economy strong. Germany is still an export powerhouse. There are signs of a certain weakening, but still its position is very strong. she left very popular, which is very important. Clearly Germans liked her, steady, somewhat conservative leadership. And she certainly established Germany as the preeminent power in the European Union.
The alliance brings to a close 16 years of rule by Angela Merkel, who chose not to run again. Germany's incoming government has agreed that EU authorities should act more urgently to defend the rule of law, including withholding EU funds if necessary.
I mean, the pressures that are pulling apart the EU are growing. I mean, after Brexit, people became frightened and decided, you know, that maybe leaving the EU was not such a great idea. But now these centrifugal forces are reasserting themselves. The EU is torn between East and West, North and South, but the East European countries are pushing a much more confrontational policy vis-a-vis Russia. They're allying themselves with the United States, and France and Germany are caught in the middle. And they're kind of trapped, and they aren't sure what to do.
The new government has ambitious plans to fight climate change by phasing out coal early and focusing on renewable energy. But their initial priority will be tackling the coronavirus pandemic. Angela Merkel served alongside four U.S. presidents, four French presidents, five British prime ministers, and eight Italian premiers. Her chancellorship was marked by four major challenges: the global financial crisis, Europe's debt crisis, the 2015-16 influx of refugees to Europe, and the coronavirus pandemic. While credited with securing huge European bailouts that saved Greece from crashing out of the Eurozone, it was achieved at a heavy social cost. Merkel was highly unpopular for being the driving force behind bailouts and austerity cuts. The policy made millions of people jobless, plunging them into poverty. Merkel also kept Germany's borders open to hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing the wars in Syria and Iraq. But the policy drew criticism from right-wing politicians. The refugee influx gave a good excuse to far-right groups to fan the flames of Islamophobia. Popular anger also sent the far-right bloc, the anti-immigration AfD, to Parliament in 2017 for the first time since World War II, making it the biggest opposition force. Merkel's government was accused of protecting Germany's vital automobile industry by watering down emissions regulation reforms, and its refusal to advance the 2038 deadline to quit coal energy also irking green activists.
And she's been caught in the middle of a lot of conflicts and has not acquitted herself especially well. And that includes the Ukraine and Iran, especially the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord. Germany under Merkel mostly towed the U.S. line and did not get very many rewards for it. They lost business opportunities in Iran, and they have been kind of chained to an increasingly erratic U.S. policy.
Her government also did not play a constructive role after the nuclear deal with Iran in 2015. Germany under Merkel practically followed the maximum pressure campaign of the U.S. against Iran and did not fulfill its obligations under the deal.
The United States withdrew all of its forces from Afghanistan in August in what was widely described as a humiliating pullout after a 20-year futile war. But America has not left the West Asia region at all, as it retains a large number of its forces in this strategic part of the world. Iraq and Syria are two of the regional countries the United States seems very reluctant to leave. The United States invaded Iraq 18 years ago and had 170,000 soldiers there in 2007, before withdrawing them in 2011. It redeployed forces to Iraq in 2014 as the Daesh terrorist group seized Iraqi territory. A large part of the Iraqi population, including resistance groups, consider the U.S. forces as occupiers. America currently has about 2,500 troops and leads another 1,000 foreign forces in Iraq. Pressure has been mounting on Iraqi officials to force the U.S. to pull its remaining soldiers out of the country. The Iraqi parliament voted in January 2020 to expel U.S. forces from Iraq. The vote came amid heightened anti-American sentiments following the U.S. assassination of Iranian anti-terror icon General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. The U.S. military on Thursday announced the end of its combat mission in Iraq. But does that genuinely change anything on the ground? The move won't reduce the number of U.S. troops in Iraq. Rather, it will keep the same numbers in, quote, support roles. Why is the United States resisting growing calls for a complete withdrawal?
The objective of the United States in Syria and Iraq is to act on behalf of Israel, strategically, that is, and to create obstacles to the governments of Syria, Iraq, and Iran, and Lebanon, for that matter, because these four nations and important parts within those four nations are, to some extent, allied. They feel themselves under oppression and attack by the United States and its allies.
Many observers believe the U.S. wants to keep its base in Iraq as part of its efforts to maintain its influence in Iraq and try to contain regional player Iran, among other goals. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said the group was created by the United States. America ironically deployed troops to Iraq and northern Syria as part of its mission to battle the terrorists. There are still hundreds of American forces in northern Syria who refuse to leave as repeatedly demanded by Damascus. This week, the Syrian president's political and media advisor, Bhutina Shaban, said the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas.
Well, the U.S. has, against all international law, walked into Syria with its military. And it has destroyed and occupied and stolen the vast majority of the oil resources of Syria in order to prevent it from getting into the hands of the Syrian government, to impoverish the Syrian people and the Syrian government, and to destroy the economy. That's what this is about.
She also denounced the repeated U.S. airstrikes against residential areas, which have caused a large number of civilian casualties over the past years. Shaban said the air raids are a severe violation of the nation's human rights and Syrian sovereignty. She called the continued U.S. military presence in Syria a naked aggression. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's forever wars. But unlike Afghanistan, there has been little talk about any U.S. withdrawal from Syria. U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans said recently that the United States would not be pulling out from northeast Syria anytime soon.
The COVID-19 pandemic prompted lengthy lockdowns and disrupted supply chains, negatively impacting the global economic growth. But one sector has been immune to the effects of the virus, the arms industry. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, the world's top 100 arms manufacturers sold a record $531 billion worth of weapons and military services last year. That figure is up by 1.3% compared to the year before. The Swedish think tank says 2020 was the sixth consecutive year in which global arms sales grew. Compared to 2015, overall sales were 17% higher in 2020. The institute explains that the government's higher demand for arms has been behind the growth in sales, which protected the industry giants from potential slumps.
I think the problem is that these weapons companies have created such powerful lobbies, and they go around the world trying to sell their weapons, oftentimes to very undemocratic governments that use these weapons to hold on to their power. So it's only a small sector of the global economy that benefits from the weapon sales. The problem is they are just too powerful, and the alliance that they make with autocratic governments gives them even more power.
According to the report, Asian countries are becoming increasingly important, as three of the 100 firms were Indian, whose sales amounted to 1.2% of the world's total, on par with South Korea. Chinese firms also sold $67 billion worth of arms last year, up by 1.5% compared to 2019. American firms constituted 41 out of 100 top arms producers, selling over $285 billion worth of arms and military equipment. That's more than Finland's annual gross domestic product. The top five manufacturers are all from the United States, including Lockheed Martin, which ranks first.
And it is very unfortunate that U.S. companies like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Boeing, General Dynamics, they are among the top weapons companies in the world, and they have tremendous power in the United States and globally to keep benefiting from death and destruction. And I think instead of weapons companies, we should refer them to them as the merchants of death, for indeed that is what they are, and what they do is sell death and destruction.
Britain's BAE Systems is in the sixth position and is the highest placed European firm, just ahead of three Chinese groups. Saudi Arabia is one of the world's top arms importers. The manufacturers are providing Riyadh with billions of dollars of weapons and equipment despite the kingdom's years-long war on Yemen, the conflict that has resulted in the death of thousands and created what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Earlier this month, France signed a $19 billion arms deal with the United Arab Emirates, under which Abu Dhabi will acquire 80 Rafale fighter jets and 12 military helicopters. Rights groups have condemned the deal and urged Paris to stop the weapons sales, citing the UAE's involvement in the war on Yemen.
Certainly the possibility of conflict is something that fuels the arms industry, and so it's in their benefit to see conflicts continue, to drum up new conflicts, to heat up the Cold War, for example, between the U.S. and China, the U.S. and Russia. Its business is selling weapons, and so it needs conflict.
The growing trend in global arms sales is particularly concerning, as they need to be used somewhere. Considering the heightened tensions worldwide between major powers, if the trend continues, the world will turn into a tinderbox.
This year, Tehran and the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear agreement have undertaken seven rounds of negotiations to settle unresolved concerns. The most recent round of discussions concluded on Friday in Vienna, Austria. In the discussions, Tehran has repeatedly indicated that it wants all the U.S. sanctions lifted. Sanctions placed by the U.S. on Iran when Washington unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018. Tehran has also consistently criticized the United States for its attitude to the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Tehran says that before discussing Iran's nuclear responsibilities under the accord, Washington must fulfill its promise to remove all anti-Iran sanctions. In an interview with ANSA, an Italian news agency, Iran's deputy foreign minister, Ali Barghadikani, stated that the Islamic Republic will not back down from its demand for the removal of sanctions against the Iranian nation. Barghadikani noted that Washington should take the first step because it was the party that quit the accord in 2018. Barghadikani is also the top Iranian negotiator in the talks over the removal of sanctions. He spoke about the draft documents Tehran presented during the latest round of negotiations in Vienna this week. Bogarty said the proposals are logical and well-founded and could be a basis for further talks. At the seventh round of negotiations in Vienna, Tehran offered its plans of action to members of the P4+1 in the form of two suggested draft documents, one relating to the removal of oppressive and unlawful U.S. sanctions, and the other to the nuclear issue. Meanwhile, the United Kingdom, France, and Germany, all signatories to the nuclear deal, have raised concern over Iran's demands, claiming that they violate the provisions of the agreement. Iran yet denies this, saying it is adhering to the text of the previous rounds, but has expanded on issues like verification of sanctions removal.
Well, it's a problem because this is not simply a rational process. The other side, effectively, is a bloc of NATO countries that are involved in a series of wars in this West Asian region, and they are desperate to hang on to some new pretext. This was an important pretext for them to try and submit Iran, to try and constrain the regional influence of Iran, which doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the nuclear issue at all. But as you can see, they've been trying to add new matters of trying to control Iran's missile capacity and so on. So,
as an informed source acquainted with the discussions told Press TV, the Islamic Republic's suggested drafts are fully compliant with the JCPOA and its principles. In an interview with Doha-based Al Jazeera on Friday, Iran's senior negotiator Ali Bagherikani also stated that Tehran's two proposed drafts cannot be rejected. In an interview with the Doha-based Al Jazeera network on Friday, Iran's top negotiator Ali Bagherikani stated that external players, particularly Zionists, are making major attempts to obstruct and disrupt the process of discussions between Iran and the P4+1 group of nations in Vienna. Right on the eve of the negotiations, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett alleged that the regime is very worried about the readiness to remove the sanctions. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman slammed the Israeli regime, saying Tel Aviv despises dialogue, since its genesis is based on war, tension, and terror. Said Khatibzadeh noted that the delegates in Vienna won't take instruction from the Israeli Prime Minister. Naftali Bennett has accused Tehran of carrying out, quote, nuclear blackmail as a negotiation tactic and urged concrete measures against Tehran. This followed the Israeli Foreign Minister's visit to the UK and France to ensure that banking sanctions against Iran will stand. Tehran has warned the parties in Vienna not to be influenced by Israeli attempts to poison the talks.
But they are always worried about being abandoned. And of course, the threats they make against Iran are utterly empty, except in the sense that they count on or they rely on the fact that were there to be a serious conflict between the Israeli colony and Iran, the U.S. would rush to back them up. But they're very worried that might not happen.
The U.S. administration of President Joe Biden had said it was willing to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it has retained the sanctions as leverage. Iran says it won't settle for anything less than the removal of all U.S. sanctions in a verifiable manner. It also wants guarantees that the U.S. would not abandon the agreement again.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The need to increase the share of knowledge-based companies in the GDP. This is a part of the speech delivered on November 17, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of the academic elite and top scientific talents of the country.
یه مسئله دیگر همین است که به بنده گفته شد از قول آقای دکتر ستاری که سهم شرکت‌های دانش‌بنیان از تولید ناخالص ملی کمتر از 1%.
Another issue is that I have been told that according to what Dr. Sattari has said, the share of knowledge-based companies in the GDP is less than 1%. Well, this is too little. This share of domestic production must definitely increase. It should at least reach 5% in the course of 3 to 4 years. They should make an effort to do this, God willing. I hope that God will help all of you. The time for the call to prayer is close and I will finish my statements. I hope that God will bestow success on all of you. You should know that the future belongs to you. Our country belongs to you. You are the ones who will build the future of this country, and you are the managers of the future of the country. You must prepare yourselves and prepare the country as well. You can do this. Of course, I recommend that the officials and ministers in the country benefit from the youth. I frequently made this recommendation to the previous administration as well, but in certain cases it was ignored. I make the same recommendation to the present administration.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
استفاده از جوانها بشه در مدیریت‌های گوناگون.
They should employ the youth in various managerial posts, including mid and low managerial positions that play an important role as specified by one of the friends in the meeting. They can employ them in high managerial positions as well. I make this recommendation to the administration in the hopes that it will be carried out. However, you too should prepare yourselves to find your own place. You yourselves should find your place and the role you wish to play in helping the country to progress. Your genius should show itself here as well. You should determine what your position will be, and then you should place yourselves in that position, struggle, and work. I hope that God the Exalted will protect you, God willing. You are the hope of the country and the nation. You are the dear children of the nation. God willing, God will keep you for the country. God willing, the pure souls of our martyrs and the immaculate soul of our magnanimous Imam will be pleased with us. And I hope that all of us will benefit from the pure prayers of the Imam of the time. May our souls be sacrificed for his sake. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets of the Gaza Strip to mark the 34th anniversary of Hamas establishment. Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas, also held a military parade, while other participants waved Hamas flags, chanting slogans in support of the resistance group.
We will keep fighting against the Israeli crimes. We will sacrifice our lives. We will keep defending our rights, and we won't remain silent. There will come a day when we all pray in Al-Aqsa Mosque and liberate our lands.
Addressing the rally, senior Hamas official Mahmoud Al-Zahar said celebrating the movement's establishment indicates that Hamas was founded to unite the Palestinian people and lead them in their struggle against Israeli atrocities.
The Palestinian resistance continues in all parts of Palestine, including the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, as long as the Israeli regime violates our rights and grabs our lands. The resistance will respond to all Israeli attacks. We praise our forces for their last battle against the Israeli attacks in Al-Aqsa and their land grab in Sheikh Jarrah. We will always remain committed to our duties of defending Palestine.
Founded in 1987, Hamas is the largest Palestinian resistance movement. Since 2007, it has ruled the besieged Gaza Strip and has since defended the impoverished enclave against four major Israeli wars, including the most recent 11-day conflict that ended in an Egyptian provocative ceasefire in May.
Hamas renewed its promise to liberate our land and defend our people. As our struggle against this occupation persists, Palestinian resistance is our shield against this Israeli regime and its violations and crimes against us, and we are certain it won't disappoint us.
People hail the Palestinian resistance for defending their rights and fighting against Israeli aggression, especially amid the recent wave of normalizing of ties with Israel. Palestinians say they will continue their resistance until the rights of the nation are restored. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Another moment of pride for Iran at the United Nations for its active partnership since joining the world body in 1950. The country has now become a full member of the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. Iran's accession was approved by a unanimous vote at the Special Political Committee of the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. UNSCEAR rarely expanded to include new members, but under the resolution proposed by Australia, four countries were admitted, raising the number to 31. Norway, Algeria, and the UAE were other nations who joined the body. Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takht Ravanchi, praised the General Assembly's decision to admit Iran into the committee. He expressed Tehran's full support for the body in its scientific endeavors to protect the planet and humans.
Iran reiterates its full support for and cooperation with the UNSCEAR in order to further enhance the infrastructure capacity and training of its personnel, as well as support nuclear safety, protect the public health and the environment from the harmful effects of atomic radiation.
Iran's accession is perceived as a major step forward since the top UN scientific body on nuclear safety has always been under Western influence. As expected, the decision faced stiff opposition from Israel and the US. Takht Ravanchi responded to anti-Iran allegations raised by Israel and the U.S. He said the track record of Tel Aviv and Washington show they are not in a position to oppose Iran's membership to the scientific committee. The Iranian envoy said that while the Israeli regime has flagrantly violated many UN resolutions and defied international efforts to contain weapons of mass destruction, Washington dishonored its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal. A nuclear scientist has hailed Iran's accession to the committee as a very positive step.
In general, it's a good move for Iran. Iran can have send some of its scientists to the mission to join the work and the effort of this committee. I think at the end it will be a very positive step for Iran.
The Vienna-based body was set up by a UN General Assembly resolution in 1955 and is affiliated with the UN Environment Program. The committee is tasked with providing information on nuclear radiation and its associated health risks and hazards. The committee's work has served as a basis for evaluating the risk of nuclear exposure and establishing best practices and protective measures.
Shock and anger was expressed outside the Royal Court of Justice in London Friday as the court ruled that jailed journalist Julian Assange can be extradited to the US to face espionage charges. The decision overturned a previous ruling that the WikiLeaks founder could not be forcibly shipped to the US due to mental health concerns.
Of course, we are slightly disappointed. It is very, very difficult to get a fair hearing from a justice system in the United Kingdom in anything which cuts across the perceived interest of the security state, be it the UK or the United States. But this is a stage in the struggle, and the legal battle and the political battle will continue.
Assange, 50, is wanted in the US on allegations of conspiracy to obtain and disclose national defense information after WikiLeaks famously posted thousands of leaked documents, spilling the beans on Western crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. His supporters, however, believe he is a true journalist whose only crime is exposing corruption and war criminals.
I had mixed emotions. I thought that he would be clear today, to be honest. Because, let's face it, all Julian has done is released crimes, not secrets. He's revealed crimes. And when someone reveals crimes, you expect the criminals to be in prison, not the man that reveals the crimes.
Fighting back the tears, Assange's fiancée, Stella Morris, said the decision will be appealed, describing the ruling as an affront to press freedom and democracy.
Julian exposed the crimes of CIA torturers, of CIA killers, and now we know that those CIA killers were planning to kill him too. How can these courts accept an extradition to the country that plotted to kill Julian, that plotted to kill a publisher because of what he published. This goes to the fundamentals of press freedom and of democracy.
Family and supporters of Assange have expressed deep disappointment and anger at today's verdict. However, his legal team have advised us that the fight is far from over, so this won't be the last time that we're out here outside the Court of Justice. Robert Carter, London.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on his people to be patient and trust his government's new economic plan. In remarks after his cabinet meeting, Erdogan said price increases in Turkey were being caused by greed and importer prices. The president also called on Turkish people who own foreign currencies to take advantage of what he called his new economic model's opportunities.
Turkey is a breakout star of the global economic system that is being restructured with the pandemic. We should completely mobilize our country's potential to this end. No one should ever forget that every penny spent on investment and production is a brick laid for the construction of the future of the great and powerful Turkey.
The plan that President Erdogan was trying to convince Turkish people to put their trust in is considered by analysts as a risk, as its results are not only imperative, but also needs time.
The government wants to bring in more foreign currency by increasing the export and, of course, with the low lira value that might encourage investors. The government is trying to attract foreign investments, thinking that this would help increase income and decrease inflation. And to encourage investors, they are lowering the interest rates. This is a risky policy, however, it can be successful. But the result of such a plan will not show now, and it will leave the current country in a bad economic situation for another few years. I'm not sure the people will support the government until then.
Turkey's lira weakened as much as 2.6% to 13.8070 against the US dollar before Erdogan spoke. Lira has lost 46% of its value to the US currency this year. Many here believe that the promises by the president may not be based on solid ground, especially that the plan is considered by economists to be risky. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Cinema Verite is the title of the only documentary film festival in Iran. The annual event is a once-in-a-year chance for documentary filmmakers from Iran and the world to get together and get their works evaluated by the festival's jury. It's the first time the annual event is held physically after the coronavirus pandemic forced the organizers to hold it online.
Last year, the event was held with no physical participation and all of the films were screened online. This year, we considered two ways, online and physical screening. And the participation was beyond our expectations. Filmmakers from Japan, South America, Germany, and France have sent their works to the festival.
551 films were submitted to the Cinema Verite Secretariat, out of which 179 works were selected and put to the contest. There's no limit for the themes. They can cover the sufferings of war-ravaged nations or deal with the socioeconomic impacts of the coronavirus. But there's one general yardstick. They need to present an unbiased portrayal of the truth.
There are four main sections of full-length, mid-length, and short documentaries, as well as the special jury prize for international works.
The competing films will be screened both online and in theaters in Iran for a week, and the best works will be honored in the closing ceremony, slated for December 16th. Through the course of the cinematic event, renowned documentarians from Iran and the world will be attending the festival to hold workshops.
Fiction films aim to entertain the audience with the imaginations of a filmmaker. But when it comes to documentaries, filmmakers must avoid the imagination factor, yet inspire people merely with realities. Realities that sometimes are ordinary, but need a second but different look. And that's what makes the competition tough in the week-long course of Cinema Verite. Yusuf Jolly, Tehran.
Demonstrations are a staple of the British democracy. A peaceful protest rally last month against the Israeli ambassador, Tzipi Hotovli, leaving a debate at the London School of Economics. The event passed off peacefully. Police made no arrests. But then came a torrent of criticism from British officials and anti-Semitism allegations from pro-Israel organizations, chiefly from the Community Security Trust, CST, a charity with the purported mission of looking after the Jewish community in the UK. Campaigners say the CST misrepresented the event as violent and linked the protesters to terrorism.
And now pro-Palestine campaigners are fighting back. They have called on the UK's charities regulator, Charity Commission, for an urgent investigation into the Community Security Trust for engaging in political activity.
There is a definition on what a charity is and what a charity should do. And, you know, to go around and receive a huge amount of money, not just from the, you know, ordinary individuals, but from the British government. I mean, British government actually gives CST huge amount of money, and they are almost embedded within the Metropolitan Police, could really damage those who are supporters of Palestine because they're well-placed and well-respected. That cannot go on.
The letter accuses the organization of routinely attacking those who organize or take part in campaigning for the rights of the Palestinians with tactics such as character assassination and false accusations, all aimed at shielding Israel from criticism.
What they are doing in the pursuit of defending undefensible, they actually begin to attack and demonize those who support Palestinian cause. And, you know, they do it to the Muslims who are doing that, non-Muslims, even those from the Jewish community that honorably is standing and defending the right of the Palestinians.
The pro-Palestine campaigners have also criticized the preferential treatment the Community Security Trust and other pro-Israel organizations receive in the UK, while their Muslim counterparts are frequently demonized. They say the ball is now in the charity regulator's court to hold the CSD to account or throw its own integrity into question. Said Purza, London.
The seventh round of talks aimed at reviving the nuclear agreement, known as the JCPOA, resumes in Vienna between Iran and the remaining signatories, Britain, France, Germany, Russia and China. Iranian lead negotiator and deputy foreign minister Ali Bagheri Kani says the removal of U.S. sanctions will pave the way for progress in talks on Tehran's return to full compliance.
Resolving differences on sanctions removal requires the serious will and practical readiness of the other side. Once the will is there, we can move toward sanctions removal, and that will create a serious opportunity for progress in talks, especially on Iran's nuclear measures.
EU coordinator Enrica Mora described the negotiations as very difficult, saying there were different positions that the sides needed to marry.
We approach this with the realism necessary to get an agreement, because it's difficult, because there are different positions, because some points are still extremely open, and we have to close them, and we have to close them, and we don't have all the time of the world.
The seventh round of talks began last week, during which Iran presented the other sides with two draft proposals, which it says are based on the 2015 nuclear agreement and the text that all sides had been working on over the previous six rounds. Bagheri said he believed the other sides had come back to Vienna with a more serious will to resume the work.
What I felt today was different from what I had felt on Friday. I feel that the other side demonstrated a more serious will to enter into effective and result-oriented talks.
The expert working group focusing on Iran's nuclear commitments is expected to resume its work on Friday, as talks also continue among various delegations on the issue of sanctions removal. As to the duration of the seventh round of talks,